is Spectrum.
Alternative Medicine. Homeopathy. Secret Society. Hypnosis. The Paranormal. Alternative Energy. UFO. Abduction. The Weird. The Wild. And the Wonderful.
With your hosts, Tom Theophanis and Scott Jordan.
Hello, good evening, and welcome to the Spectrum Radio Network on BBS Radio 2. I'm Scott Jordan here, my co-host, Tom Theophanis, and remember, there's no such thing as too much information. Hey, Tom, how you doing, buddy?
Hey, Scott, how you doing?
There's that recorded, hey, Tom, how you doing thing coming up.
Yeah, it always is.
What do we got tonight?
Well, tonight we have a special guest. His name is Michael Therrien. He was born in Northern Ireland and is an expert on the occult histories of Ireland and America. He has made the deepest researches into Atlantis, the origins of evil, and the Irish origins of civilization. He is the author of the acclaimed books Atlantis, Alien Visitation and Genetic Manipulation, Astrotheology and Sidereal Mythology, and the Irish Origins of Civilization. He is the producer and presenter of the Origins of and Oracles DVD series that explores the ancient mysteries and forbidden knowledge, and he's also the producer of the Architects of Control DVD series. And tonight, we're going to be discussing symbol literacy and the age of manipulation. Welcome to our show, Michael.
Welcome, Michael.
Hello?
Hello? Hello? Michael, he did warn us that
I'm back. Thank you.
Oh, okay.
I thought we lost you there for a sec.
No. I can hear you now.
No, sorry about that. You're having little trouble with your internet today.
Yeah, we've had a bit of trouble with the weather and everything, but thanks again for the invitation. I appreciate it.
It's my pleasure, and I'm glad to have you. Okay, maybe we could start out just for those people, two or three people on the planet who haven't heard of you. Just a quick bullet point on how you got interested in looking into these fields.
That's been for a long time. Started back in Ireland and then picked up steam heavily in the States. The original work was commenced around about between 1979 and 82. It was very much in the dark. I was just looking at things in the broadest outlines. And then when I hit the States, where they have more research material, and then they have a lot of great researchers like Eustace Mullins and G. Edward Griffin and others, it picked up some steam then. And then certainly in the 90s, around about the time of Desert Storm, almost at the beginning of Desert Storm, then things got very heavy, start studying in greater detail the whole matrix of control. It was many stages. I think the original questions started to form for me in Britain, in Ireland, but the answers were very far and few between, and it just took a lot of dedication and continual digging into these subjects. Again, mostly in the States, because that's where they have the bookstores, that's where they had the more seasoned researchers. There's a very few of quality in Europe, but at that time, it was really an American thing, where you could pick up books and listen to people explaining basically what was going on. Some of those people put the focus a lot on the Americas in particular, and the rise of the federal orgs. But what really had intrigued me was that various experts in this field, including the ones I just mentioned, and also, say, for instance, Dr. John Coleman and even Lyndon LaRouche and his team, they started to allude to the whole British matrix of control. And that very much intrigued me because, of course, coming out of Britain, this rang true. And I knew that a lot of the people who were reading their works didn't get that, didn't understand the incredible significance of the role of the British government or the British oligarchical system in America. But for me, it was immediate, bells went off right away. And that got me intrigued because being Irish, we know all about colonialization and all about these kinds of machinations. And then I just couldn't believe it that the same forces, basically, were seeking to undermine the Americas. And then that's when my, you know, journey really started to get much more passionate into this, and the pieces started to slowly to fall together. And that's also the same with symbolism, because that's what I was doing back in the 80s. Was my initial interest in all of this came around because of basically the symbolism aspect.
The symbol literacy aspect.
Definitely.
Maybe we can drill down into that. Symbol literacy. Where did you start coming across that? I remember you saying that you were getting magazines at an early age, and you kept seeing the same symbols over and over and over again, and that intrigued you.
It did. At that point, it soon moved on from there into television, watching the graphics, looking mostly at the kind of rock and roll, or even the new wave, or the kind of punk. This is like late 70s into the 80s, watching the incredible graphics and the weird symbolism. You know, now we know it, because since my work, there's been a huge absolute tidal wave of this kind of work being done by people on YouTube and everything. So with the Lady Gagas and what have you, people are kind of up to speed on this.
Exactly, yeah.
But back then, it was like pulling teeth if you tried to say, you know, why did Duran Duran or The Cure, you know, why are they using that symbolism? I mean, that's pretty much necrophiliac right there, or that's Kabbalistic, or that's alchemical. I mean, it was just like, what? It went right over people's heads, and they thought I was Boogaloo, you know. But actually, I just persisted. And then from there, it went into the architecture to discover the alignments, the ley lines. I can't say exactly when it started, but it was something that did intrigue me to understand that, yes, there was these recurrent symbols. Later on, I find out that a lot of these are secret society symbols. That, again, didn't happen right away, but slowly it started to show me that basically, in a nutshell, the kind of control that is operating in the world, one of the reasons why people just shake their heads, one of the reasons why it is unseen, one of the reasons why there's resistance, is because it is absolutely unseen. And so in one way, you can kind of understand it when people just don't want to know and they think you're crazy, because I started to realize that that architecture of control is, in fact, unseen. It deals with color. It deals with number. It deals with rhythm. It deals with the use of light. It deals with these esoteric and more exoteric symbolism. And that's why it passes people by in exactly the same way as the motifs, say, in the architecture of a church or a college or a university. People walk on it every day, walking on checkered floors, without the faintest idea that that's a symbol going back to, say, the Templars, the Cistercian order. They live their whole life and never wonder why they walk on that checkered floor as they cross the quadrangle to go into their classes to be indoctrinated. And then I suddenly realized, well, wait a minute, it's not just these British colleges or these ones in Dublin and Belfast. You come to the United States of America, there's the same colonial architecture. There's exactly the same motifs. Right. You know,
you mentioned this stuff about architecture. If you say the name Falconelli to people, a vast majority of people say who?
Yeah, or Vitruvius or Pico della Mirandola, all these great names. Yeah, maybe Leonardo da Vinci and Michelangelo, sure, maybe Raphael. You get a bit of a like, oh yeah, that sounds familiar. But the moment that you go a little bit, you know, more than that, into names that are very, very important for our world, then they're lost. Most people couldn't even tell you who was it who designed Washington, D.C. or Philadelphia. You know, this kind of thing started to irritate me when I was in America, because I couldn't believe it, that people did not know what the government symbols meant, that they didn't know that they were Judaic or that they were British Israelite. They didn't know that they were Egyptoid. They didn't look at the dollar bill and have any suspicions about any of these Masonic orders or these fraternities. It was complete and utter ignorance, pretty much wall to wall. And I don't know what I would have done if I hadn't have actually persisted and then did find the literature, which was a salvation for me, because I needed answers and I needed them quick, and I wasn't getting them from anybody that, you know, was bumping into at all.
Right. Other than, you know, you bumped into Jordan Maxwell. And
that's
that
later.
Oh, yeah, okay. This was much earlier, was it? Okay.
This is certainly a few years later in America, and much earlier when the questions were formed. And don't forget, you see, all this time I'm just working retail. It's wonderful to go and browse these bookstores, and then you look at the prices of the backs of the books, and you're thinking, well, hold on here.
Yeah, I know.
You're not going to be able to afford a very decent library. And, these bookstore owners looking down their nose at you don't really want you to be sitting there for 5 hours in your Motorhead t-shirt browsing their books and you know, greasing up their store. So you're in a paradox, because now it meant for me, specifically for me, it meant that I did spend the money. I actually worked as hard as I could and spent every single dime that I could have, you know, on the literature, because it was an absolute treasure to have. And I realized how precious it was to be in the States and to be having access to these books. So I wasted no time, because I actually have a long history of animosity with bookstores in Britain. So by the time I got to the States, and it's not really as bad as I was making out, you know, with the bookstore owners there, but I really, really realized this is my moment. I've got to get my hands on this stuff now. And one thing led to the other. And then I literally became sort of my own little expert, in a way, if you want to call it that, into esoteric books and into rare books. You know, one thing just developed and developed, and I started to know where to go and get the books, which ones were sort of, you know, fraudulent and which ones had great information. So I started then to spend as much money as I could and collate and get together some of these prize works, which then has now, of course, stood me great, because those have become the bedrock of the research that I've done and that I've put into my works and then offered to the world at large, these sources and references. So it did actually it turned out to be a benefit. At the time, there was no motive and there was no desire to do anything with it. So I didn't have that clue at the time that this was going to have a payoff or anything like that, or I'd suddenly, you know, tomorrow I'd be on radio and TV. You know, none of that ever was even in my consciousness, nor was it a desire, but it was just simply a love of the work and getting to put these pieces together to understand what on earth was going on in the world.
Do you find that you're a perfectionist in the way that I remember seeing snippets of the Origin and Oracles series, 22 DVDs, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah. And I thought, wow, he must really put a lot of thought into this. And it seems to be coming from a perfectionist point of view, that once you've gathered all of this information, you thought, well, nobody's really putting this information out there exactly the way I would put it out if I was to put it out. Therefore, I must put it out. You know what I mean?
I do know what you mean. What happened was that, I must say, and I don't mean this in any sort of flippant way, every single thing that's happened in my life, but for our purposes, since I started anything professional, was accident.
Okay.
It was never planned or anything like that. Jordan pushed me to continue. I mean, you know, doing things behind my back to put the word out about me and things like that. And other people did the same thing. The Atlantis book, you know, was the same. Somebody said that they were going to, a friend of mine said, you know, if you put it together in more of a book form, they'll be happy to edit it for free. And they kind of coerced me to do that. So, and then I had my, when you just mentioned the Origins and Oracles series, that was based on basically Joseph Campbell. He was one of my great heroes. And when I came to think, you know, how am I going to present all this esoteric knowledge that I've been studying all these years? I think I was actually either watching his famous series, because again, here we are in America. That's on, you know, you can find channels in which they just completely replay, or at least they did in those days, you know, the Joseph
PBS,
Campbell.
PBS, right? Yeah.
Yeah, PBS, yeah. So I don't know if I was sitting down watching it, or I had some of his tapes, and even if I didn't, it was so fresh in my mind. I've always loved his work. So that kind of gave me a little bit of an understanding of how to present it. You know, just get a studio, just stand there or sit there and just babble away, you know, do your thing and do it in that kind of style. And it worked. It really did work, because
It does.
You know, it came out great. So I wouldn't say that I'm a perfectionist, but what I am is, like, I'm that guy in the soccer field that when you get the ball, I'll just go right out the stadium door and, you know, with it. Once I've got it in my hand, I'm just going to run and run and run with it. So I'm more like what you would call dogged or just persistent and tenacious. I don't think it's really perfectionism, really. To others, it may seem that way. To me, it's just more like when I get my head into something, I can't let it go.
And you'll run with it all the way. I remember Joseph Campbell's series on PBS in Canada, and I remember seeing it one time, and then they were going to replay it again. And I went out and I bought a whole bunch of VHS tapes.
Yeah.
And the next time it came on, I stayed up and taped the entire series. Mm-hmm. Just because it impacted me. I mean, that man was, I thought he was a guru. You know, I mean, I hung on his every word. The stories he would tell, and he's looking at it from a nonlinear sense.
Yeah, he did a multi-length series called, I think, Transformations of Myth Through Time. I watched that a lot. It took me quite a few years to even get a videotape machine when we were living in the States. And so I missed being able to tape it myself. So I just used to catch it on PBS, like you say, and watch it as much as I could. And then I think rented a couple of the videos. And we in Ireland, they had shown the series that he did with Bill Moyers. And we used to catch that every time it came on. Things like that were very rare in the late 80s, where the Thatcherite government had completely crushed all spiritual or mystical type of television. They have a lot of the pseudo stuff, that they got in plenty. But the real meat was very lacking. So when Campbell's work came on British TV, we caught those. We listened to those assiduously. I think a friend of mine taped them. And then when I got to the States, I continued. That was definitely in my mind. Because remember, one thing about Campbell was his work is syncretic, like mine is. It's eclectic. There's so many different disciplines that you have to bring together. So without having listened to him, I don't think I maybe would have been able to do it. Because my work is distinctive because it is also very, very eclectic. How do you bring all those pieces together? So I really lucked out there by being familiar with his work, and then had a bit of a more confidence to say, yeah, I can do that. You know, I'll bring all these pieces together and I'll put my little storyline to it. And then all of a sudden it was extremely successful, which it wasn't planned at all. It was unplanned that it would be in any shape or form successful. That wasn't even the plan when I made it. Mm-hmm. Can't emphasize that enough. It was just more to try and get the information out. DVDs hadn't even been around that long, as a matter of fact, so the medium was even quite new, and certainly new to me, but it worked out fantastic, you know, and people really dug what I was doing.
Right. Tom, do you have a question?
Yeah, I was wondering, Michael, when you sort of started in this, did you start with a particular area specifically, or you just were all over the place?
No, there was a couple that really had my interest. One was this subliminal content that you find in the billboards, that you find in the magazines, and then, as I said, on the TV videos of and I don't mean just the musical videos. I mean the graphics that they'll have before news programs, umpteen commercials, all of that stuff that I've worked with ever since. That, for some bizarre reason, did fascinate me. And then it moved from there into the architecture of Britain, and I must add to that also the phenomena that of Earth zodiacs, you know, or any type of old megalithic
structures.
Yeah, that exist out there, like the Glastonbury zodiac and the Kingston zodiac and what have you. It started to move into that field as well. It was mostly that. It was mostly the sacred geometry, the ley lines, a bit of numerology and the divination arts tying into the symbolism. This was certainly the bed of it all. This is from which everything else grew. My studies on Atlantis all grew out of my interest in Irish mythology and so on. So it basically, all of the seeds were planted in that place, in that time, you know, just hanging out in Ireland and studying. I was on the dole, of course, at that time. No hope of getting any jobs there, you know. At that time, it was awful, you know. And so it was just a matter of trying to eke out an existence open your eyes to what all this symbolism is. And the one good thing about Britain is that symbolism is everywhere. So you have no shortage
of it.
Easy to find, yeah. And then...
Out of curiosity... yesterday I was watching a couple of videos on Atlantis and some of the ideas of where Atlantis may be. Have you got any thoughts on to that as to where?
Oh yeah, I concur with these latest findings. I think I wrote that on the forum. I've always said that it was in the Atlantic. That in fact, most consensus is that it is in the Atlantic at some area. And so these latest findings, I would conclude, are Atlantis. They're spot on, and I've been predicting that for years. Even in the introduction of the Atlantis book, I talk about that many of the revelations pertaining to man and his ancient history and his past will be discovered in the following 10 years. And that book was written in 2002.
Okay,
so, you know, we're practically coming up in the 11th hour where enormous discoveries are going to be made. They are being made every month. And this new discovery, where they actually have now conclusively found Atlantis, it's really makes me feel very inspired. You know, it's right on that timeline. It's right in that chronology of which I spoke. And if anything, the legends that I'm familiar with always said that it was up there in the Atlantic, more in the northern part of the Atlantic, where the British Isles and even Iceland would have been. But even right. if they're finding land masses even south of that, it's good to go. It's all part of that.
Actually, one of the shows that I was watching yesterday was these fellows that were out in southern Spain, but on the Atlantic side, like beyond Gibraltar there, in one of the areas where there is like a swamp, a very old swamp. And they had some aerial photographs of possibly what, you know, the description of Atlantis was.
That's a little bit too far south, because in the ancient legends they talk about at least five islands or five archipelagos or five continents even that have sank. And early Celtic mythology talks about Lyonesse, which is somewhere between Britain and France that sank. This is an island. Right. There's a place called Tyrrhenia. And that's similar to Mediterranean. So in the Mediterranean basin, they think there's a sunken continent there, which is often mistaken for Atlantis. There's Oceania, which is, and Beringia. You know, so there's a whole lot of these continents, and there's probably more that have disappeared beneath the waves and have been given the name just simply ubiquitously Atlantis. So anytime anybody sees any like stonework or pillars underneath the water, and maybe it's for publicity, I don't know, or maybe it's just pure enthusiasm, they always say it's Atlantis, and that's a little bit misgiven, because actually Atlantis was a real place and it existed in one location, but that doesn't mean that there
But it wasn't an island, right? It was a sort of a continent, wasn't it?
That's what it's meant to be, but again, that could be wrong. But again, yeah, you're right to say that, because most of the scholars say that it was a large land mass, and I even go so far as to think that it actually included England and Ireland and Iceland and Greenland. I believe that those are actually remnants of Atlantis. Atlantis was once attached to those lands.
Right.
But Plato's description, though, of how the thing looked like, though, the city, how it looked like, you know, now they also say that, you know, that what they found in the island of Crete looks, you know, a lot like it as well.
Yeah. I personally have no belief that Atlantis was in the Mediterranean. There is a continent there, or there is an island there, some sort of perhaps outpost of Atlantis, or another civilization that sank, that Sardinia and Syracuse and Crete and all of the Cretan. There's something there under the water, no doubt about it, but I think it's a little bit misgiven. But then you know as well as I do that these archaeologists, the moment that they raise the flag and say it's Atlantis, then they're going to get their budget.
Right,
so
there you go.
In many ways, they have to, and it's media attention galore, don't forget. So I can understand it, you know. But I mean, it's getting a bit like the Marx Brothers. Is it here? Is it there? Is it here? Is it there? It's in Bolivia. No, yeah. it's in Canada. You know, come on, it's going to be in one place. But everybody wants to, like Indiana Jones, say they have discovered it, and they've discovered Atlantis. So some people put the cart a little bit before the horse, you know.
That's true.
But really, when you think about it, though, if you know, the Greeks in those days and their knowledge of, you know, whatever the known world was, it hadn't gone past Gibraltar. So it most likely would have had to have been, you know, close enough, you know, even if it was in the Atlantic, somewhere in that vicinity, within reach of whatever boats they had.
That's a very good point. And, of course, one, you know, I never say that I'm right in any of this. We're all trying to study and discover this together. You're right to a point because, of course, Herodotus, the famous Greek historian, was completely, you know, out to lunch when it came to places a little bit too far away from Greece. He was hopeless. So you're right. There was a terrible insularness. They were good in some respects, but in many others, when it came to far-flung lands, they were hopeless, you know, in describing those places. At the same time, then one has to say, well, wait a minute. That could be mitigated against the fact that Plato's father, Solon, had gone to Egypt. So there, even though some of the historians were not as good as what you have today or in later periods of history, at the same time, they did have an ancient archive that probably we don't have access today because of the Vatican or whoever, but might have been even these people may have actually had contact with travelers, with Phoenicians and Egyptians, you see, and all of these Cretans, who maybe also knew about more further far-flung places, because some of the evidence that is coming in absolutely shows you that some places like Egypt and Babylon were connected to the Indies and to Americas, right, and so forth and so on. Even the latest discoveries they've made now up your way in Canada about the Native American Indians coming across the Bering Strait, they've now found the tools of a far earlier group of people just within the last couple of months that show that, you know, the whole Indian idea is a little bit now losing steam, because they've discovered far more primitive remains, sophisticated remains of an earlier group that couldn't have come across the Bering Strait because there was no ice at the time of those findings.
So do you think that the, you know, the Europeans and the Egyptians and those type of folks and they're from the Mediterranean would have made it across the Atlantic at some point?
Yeah, there's no doubt in my mind that they all came from Atlantis or these other places. That's in their own legends, by the way. It's not me saying that. They say that just before and after the fall of Atlantis, there was a migration, a very hurried migration, east and west of the same peoples. And this is part of the reason why the customs and the beliefs and the motifs and even language tropes are similar in America, South America, and North America. And also you find them similar in the Indus Valley or wherever, even in Spain, as you mentioned, in Andalusia. And for instance, as far-flung places like you know, the steppes of Russia and Ukraine, and then, of course, in Scandinavia and Ireland as well. So there's no doubt in my mind that there was a connection between peoples in the past.
Yeah, that makes sense. Do you have a time frame in mind for Atlantis?
Yeah, I think that the worst happened around 13,500 years ago. I'm always open with the dates because new evidence is always coming in, but it seems that the consensus amongst the very highest archaeologists who have looked into this is around 13,500, massive cataclysms up until 8,000, when you even have a thing called the Bronze Age famine happening in Ireland and the Storega tsunami at 3,000. So from about 13,500 years ago until about 3,000 BC, that's almost right, a 7,000-year period. You have over a 7,000-year period. You have nothing but volcanoes.
Upheaval,
unimaginable upheaval all over the world, not localized, but like I say, all over the world. I have a list of them in the Irish Origins book, and I think even on the appendices site, I have a list of these coterminous or quite close famines, droughts, enormous upheavals, cosmological disasters and what have you, raining down on the earth. And this was a blink of the eye ago, and that's why you find it in the mythologies and the histories of the world, always talking about some sort of cosmological events, of great cataclysms, the moon being a different size, the earth reeling out of control, the sun rising in the west as opposed to the east, all these bizarre almost cosmological anecdotes, which will only make sense, as Emmanuel Velikovsky and others labored to show, and Commons Beaumont as well, that this only makes sense when you understand that something of an enormous nature happened. You know, the sky turning black. I mean, it's even in the Bible where they talk about this kind of thing over and over again. And it's, to me, it's a simplicity itself to understand. And we even see tsunamis and devastation today. Well, look, it's the same thing in the past.
Yeah, I mean, look what just happened with Japan, right?
Exactly.
I mean, that was incredible, really. And, you know, who knows? Maybe they had nuclear plants back then, too.
I think they did. And, you know, the thing is that with the amount of cataclysm that happened and the rising of the waters, that's the reason why the land bridges that connected these land masses we were talking about just a few minutes ago, but particularly the land masses that are between Britain and Europe and Britain and France, they're gone, they're history. They're sank beneath the waves. And I know that the elites know about those. I know they know that. It's a no-brainer because they've also taken satellite photographs in recent history. All of these land bridges that nobody had ever mentioned except in mythology, that a land bridge existed between Sri Lanka and India, and about 10 years ago or less, they went and filmed it from satellite, and now you can go online and look at it. But if you had said that to anybody 20 years ago, they'd say, you're crazy. Now they've actually gone and taken photographs of it. Well, it's the same story on Britain. There was a land bridge between Britain and Norway and the continent, and also to France, and also one to Ireland. They were all connected. They look completely different than they do today.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting.
When do you think the deluge occurred, or roughly?
Well, there's been several. The big one was about 13,500 years ago, and then there was what might be, in, from a British point of view, or a Norwegian point of view, a thing called a Storega tsunami. Storega means large. Stor is large. So it was a large tsunami up in the north of Scotland towards Scandinavia. You know all those fjords that everybody raves about in Norway?
Yeah.
That's what caused it. That's one of the reasons why that land looks so jagged. All hell broke loose, like cannot even be imagined. And it sank a lot of Scotland. It sank the coastland of Norway so that you have these fjords that now appear to be the coastline. They weren't.
Yeah. And that happened about no gently sloping.
God almighty. No way. And did you know that about 2 years ago they found the exact same thing in Ireland, on the coast of Ireland, that it was land that broke away. They're all confused, all these National Geographic things. They went out on the latest ship with the latest technology to take sound, sonar, and photographs of the coastlines of the whole of north of Ireland. I think they did the whole of Ireland, and they were shocked to find evidence of cataclysm, not slow erosion. They can't even explain it. Well, it's easy to explain if they paid attention to the Beaumonts and the Velikovskys and the catastrophists who right. labored for years to say that this had happened. The folk tales know it. The fishwives know it. All these villages for years and years and years knew that the stuff that used to wash up, you know, on the beaches where it came from, or sometimes when they had a heavy storm and the tide was out, you could even see the remains of these ancient places. And in the folklore of these coastal places, it's always been known that the fairy lands are out there. Don't go near there. They're the fairy lands, the ancient ones. You know, this is well known in Ireland and Scotland, but nobody pays that any mind. But now science is catching up and trying to tell you they invented it.
Right, yeah. Right, right. They've come up with it now.
Yeah, right. We should bow our heads to them, almighty Royal Academy, the Royal, you know, the Geographic Institute. Let's bow our heads in shame to them that they are going to tell us all that happened. And forget about all them unmarked graves of the maverick scholars who died in agony and poverty telling you all about it, going against the flow, going against the establishment. Yeah, well, they're all forgotten.
Being blackballed.
You bet. And America too, the great, great, great people there, the great mavericks, like Ignatius Donnelly and Edgar Casey and so many others I could mention.
Oh, I actually have a question about Edgar Casey. That was sent in. Would you like to hear it?
Uh-huh.
Okay. Josh sends this question in. Edgar Casey had many descriptions of the Atlantean civilization. He indicated that they used the Earth's energies focused through massive crystals in order to accomplish many tasks. They were able to project their senses outside of space-time and read the information present there. They were able to transmute souls from body to body, and they were able to focus the Earth's energies back in on itself as a weapon, apparently causing the Earth's crust to fracture, ending their civilization. Casey indicated that the Atlanteans were taking bodies once again. Is it possible that many of the technologies we hear being experimented on, from Montauk to Looking Glass to the HARP systems, are the very same technologies the Atlantean used? And if so, will they once again destroy this civilization if left unchecked?
Well, almost yes to almost all of that. And if he's read my Atlantis book, he'll know exactly that I concur with a great deal of that. In a nutshell, I do believe that there was super technologies in the past. I believe they were destroyed by these cataclysms. A lot of them were destroyed anyway. And that the so-called historical age, from the opening of about, 7,000 years ago, whatever, have been slowly being nudged forward by this hidden Atlantean hand in order to do exactly what the questioner is asking there, which is to rebuild the technologies that had been lost. This is central to my entire thesis. For instance, even the anecdote about the crystals there, there could be no doubt about it, since how many crystal skulls have been discovered that not a single scientific institute has a clue how they were manufactured?
Right.
If you go to the ancient Irish legends, which date from about 8,000 to 10,000 years ago, up in the north of Ireland, two giants who are in the stories of the sagas are meant to be, you know, sort of evil or whatever you want to call it. They owned or ran a tower made of glass from which they used to view the whole of the country of Ireland. You know, they were like sort of like Sauron, you know, and tall kings.
All right.
The rings. They were kind of figures like that. And what do you know? What do you actually read in the Irish ancient legends? Not in any fiction, but in the actual Irish legends, that they were able to monitor the entire continent of Ireland, or the not continent, but the entire land of Ireland, monitor it because they were receiving taxes and they were oppressing the people, with a large, what they call, seeing crystal. And this seeing crystal was housed in a tower of glass on Tory Island. Now, go figure. Well, we know that 99% of the people will fling the book across the room when they hear references like this in their own legends and mythologies, because they've been brought up and they've been trotted on down in their uniforms to those schools and been brainwashed, and they do not have that independent mind, that open mind. I had it, so I took a second glance. Then I took a third glance. Then I started to ask questions, see, and I moved forward. But of course, we know that, you know, 9 times out of 10 people will just say, what is this? This is Walt Disney. It doesn't make any sense. But what treasures of knowledge is there? The cauldron of life, which is capable of bringing people back to life again. The High King of Ireland with an arm made of silver. Are we talking cybernetics here? The sun god had a lance that could fly on its own. And they even called it, they even said that this lance that he had, the spear, sought out its enemies. It would fly through the battlefield and seek out its enemies. And if anyone came near it, their fingernails, their hairs radiation. Would fall. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. It would move up under its own power.
That's right. Same thing.
And anybody who came near it, get radiation poison.
And then in the Mahabharata, because the question that you just read also hinted on the suppression, in the Mahabharata, when similar passages were found that not only spoke about these weapons, these heat-seeking weapons and their awesome power, I've gone into this in the Dantas book, but also when anecdotes in the Mahabharata in India were found talking about the Vimanas, you know, the famous flying ships.
Yep.
What happened? The British institutes that were translating those documents excised all references to that kind of thing. It was only added in later, after the British withdrawal, when Hindu Brahmin translators decided, look, let's just do justice to the book and put these back. And then the whole sump caught on fire. For many years, there was a conscious, deliberate editing process to make sure that none of the references were in those translations at the turn of the 19th century. It was only later on that they were re-put back in. And then people like David Hatcher Childress, another great American scholar and writer, people like that read them and brought that knowledge to the mainstream, brought that knowledge to us.
Yeah, and said, hey, this sounds a lot like flying ships. They're, like UFOs that they're talking about. And the ancient Sumerians writing about Shems.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
The Shems. Many, many examples of this. And the Abydos.
Right.
Flower of Life that nobody can explain how it's been etched. Either it's the one at Abydos or there's another one that the etching is far too deep for any physical tool to have done it. All over the world. I mean, it's unbelievable when you get into it. Like I said, the crystal skulls, these anecdotes that turn up in mythology, heat-seeking weapons, cauldrons of life, cybernetics, witchcraft, things that are now put down as being sorcery and witchcraft, but they could have been technology of a kind. All you have to do is change your settings a bit. And more intriguing, which was where my work comes in specifically, are the references to the genetics, the potential of having the genetic interference, and the technology to even interfere with the genetics of humankind, which for me opened a very, very big door.
Now, was that a difficult door to walk through? I mean, I know what you're talking about because I came across that myself, and that one was a little bit. That was a big meal to eat for me, and I started looking at all the ancient cultures and stuff, and looking at them like, you know what. That does seem to be what they're saying, that humans have been genetically manipulated.
Yeah, absolutely. And it wasn't difficult for me because, remember, in the 1970s, you had Eric von Däniken, you had Zachariah Sitchin delving deeply into the genetics. And they wrote about it or certainly Zachariah Sitchin had written about it in connection to the gods. Yeah, some sort of thing connecting to the Nephilim. A lot of things I agree with, a lot of things I don't, but they had already sort of opened the door, And then there was a brilliant author in England that's far less known, although I reference him in my work, is a man called Brinsley de la Poor Trench. Brinsley de la Poor Trench was a guy who also, I think, made more sense of the genetic thing. I took over sort of his work and adapted it and changed it because I thought he was inconsistent and off in certain areas. And I brought my research to bear. And basically after, again, you know, 10 years more of just continual research, the pieces start to fall into play. And I presented my story in the Atlantis book. There's no doubt in my mind, personally, that they had this knowledge. There's just too many references. And remember, those are only the references that we have. What about the thousands upon thousands of books that have been destroyed? Or even, they say destroyed, but I think more like buried, taken away, sequestered.
Or destroyed via deluge. I mean, there's right. There's some research that's being done out there. I mean, it's possible. But that they found fallout residue going down in the through geology, and they're marking it at around 50,000 years ago. So if there was nuclear fallout 50,000 years ago, what does that say about, you know, even previous societies to Atlantis?
Well, you asked the question about when do you think the deluge happened. In the Atlantis book, I do mention the 50,000 years ago because of that point.
Yes.
Because even though the consensus is, and I go along with the consensus just for convenience sake, 13,500 years, there is an equal body of knowledge, an equal body of findings that say it happened 50,000 years ago. And that's the date that I actually did put into the Atlantis book. So there's not enough evidence yet to decide right. on which one of the two. So we have to go with both. Because there was
Michael Cremo is doing a lot of work in that area too, with ancient archaeology, where
yes.
you know they're finding stuff that is impossibly old, and being buried in the basements of the museums and not being put on display because it doesn't fit the paradigm. Therefore, it doesn't make sense. Therefore, you're not going to get to see it.
Yeah, and Michael and I have talked about this personally. I love his work. He has gone and shown that there's these artifacts that have come out of deep strata, like you said, in the geology record, yeah. far too deep down in the strata. Of course, that could be explained if there was massive cataclysms that overturned things. Then you'd find these things very deep.
That's true, yeah.
But nevertheless, again, that would still destroy the official line that don't even believe in it. That they don't even believe in catastrophe. They just say it's uniformitarian. Whether or not it was – if you're finding stuff that deep, then it doesn't matter whether it was land overturned or it was put there in the strata. That is evidence of catastrophe, no matter what way you cut it.
Yes, and it's also evidence of a possibly more advanced history than we're aware of or that we're willing to admit.
Yes, and you see the lies. This is what. Then you ask. You've been hinting several times. What kept me motivated?
Yeah.
The one thing that I really get hot about and the thing that really got me committed to this is when I start realizing that the fact that we were not reading this information wasn't just by accident.
Right.
When I started to realize, well, how come I have to spend so much money on these books and how come they're so hard to find and how come this knowledge is not available to everybody and how come we're being taught all this rubbish in school and from the official sources, finally even my slow brain start to work out, it's not an accident that that's the case. And that's what got me very, very, very intrigued and much more on the scent. Because then I started to understand there's a predator loose.
Right.
And this is a lie mechanism loose. And now you have to shift gear and not only be studying the information that you first thought you were going to be studying. Whoa, what a perfect world that would be. Nope. You now have to multitask because you got another thing to be studying, and that is this hidden leviathan of lies. So your job description has just shifted.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And now you got to figure out, well, why would they do that?
Exactly. So people think, oh, yeah, Michael, how come you were into that? Listen, I didn't sit down and plan this. One thing just led to the other. You're pulling a string. The string becomes a rope. The rope becomes a chain. The chain becomes a giant thing. What is going on here? Look, I just went fishing one day. I didn't know this was all going to happen. What am I pulling out of the darkness? One thing just led to the other. And the thing is, I just stick with it no matter how dirty and greasy and filthy it gets. You just keep on going because it's interesting. And I think it's this, to me, has always been a spiritual thing, a holy work. But then you suddenly find it's not just a mere intellectual process by which you're putting pieces together and having a wonderful time collating information. you suddenly realize there's an adversary at work, a monkey on your back, a shadow that as soon as you turn your back, somebody moved the cards. You know, something,
right?
There's something going on here, right?
There's a shadow complex.
That's right. There's a whole thing going on, and then you have now more balls to juggle. You've got to face the fact that there is a conspiracy at large, and then you're into that now, you see, and then that leads on to something else, and something else, and something else. So I had no choice then but to start talking openly about this other matrix of control, not just the knowledge. I found that people were quite intrigued about the knowledge, because that's nothing more than just your normal, oh yeah, Arthur C. Clarke, you know, unexplained, you know, or Ripley's Believe It or Not. You'll get a few winks. You'll get some interest if you talk about those things. But bring conspiracy to the table, and the reason why the whole human race is completely under state of mind control, that's where you get the yawns, that's where you get the silence, or that's when you get the wide eyes thinking he's crazy.
Or the snickers.
Yeah. As long as you want to talk about Bigfoot and Atlantis, yeah, you'll get your fair share of an audience.
Mm-hmm.
But the moment you want to talk about Illuminati, hidden conspiracies, and the fact that the whole human race is mind-controlled into a state of almost like swinedom, slavocracy, yep, people got to go. They're going to catch that bus.
Oh, look at the time.
Yeah, look at the time. The mall's closing.
Yeah, you're threatening my personal outlook on myself. Please don't do that. I need to go.
That's right. That's when the things get really problematic. As long as you want to entertain them with something to do with, you know, nuclear weapons in ancient times and all that, yeah, they might give you a little hearsay, you know, and all that. And edify us with the sagas of Arthur and the Round Table. Yeah, you'll have friends.
Yeah,
you'll party.
But I mean, if you start talking about ancient history and how the we might as well get into the age of manipulation, because that's basically what you're talking about. But if we're talking about the age of manipulation, we're not talking about the last 20 years, are we?
No, we're talking about thousands in the years. You know, I mean, this is the whole thing. What happened to me is I have no problem. I'm making fun of it there, but I don't have it. I don't care whether people followed me or not. To me, it was absolutely imperative to carry on. I was able to make that leap that David Icke always talks about. Can you leave the square? And you know, are you able to do it? For me, that was no problem. For other people, it is a big problem.
Can you leave the reality box?
Yeah.
Are you comfortable outside of the reality box that everybody else exists in, basically?
I was ever in it, so it was dead easy for me to leave it because I was never in it in the first place.
And yeah. So
but you're right. If you start talking about Montauk, if you start talking about global satanic child ritual sacrifice groups, you're probably going to find yourself not invited to too many parties anymore, you know? Your rating, your thumb, you know, the thumbs are down and the ratings are real low. But then that's a point where other people will give up. People go, back into the box. For me, it was like, the hell with you people. This is very intriguing and I'm going to study it. I'm going to carry on. So, you know, that's basically what happened more circa 1990s. Then I just started to get into that whole area and study more of the hidden matrix of control. I didn't let the other stuff go, of course. I kept on doing that, but more and more importantly, especially after Desert Storm, because a lot of things started coming out in the open as well. And not only that, but the wall coming down, let's not forget about the so-called freedom of the Eastern Bloc and the so-called freedom of South Africa and lots of different things were happening that we shouldn't forget.
When in fact, a lot of that was just absorption.
Ah, of course. You think the West would be better off because of that?
Yeah.
So exactly. But though, at least what we can say is that there was a certain political upheaval, a certain amount of awakening, you know. So this started to become a little bit more social. It was the early stages of what we have today, which is a much more massive global awakening that's even scaring the bejesus out of the controllers.
I agree with that.
On one thing, though, I find that, you know, we always use the word mythology. How come we don't use the word history? Because when the Greeks and the Egyptians and whatever stories they had of their time, why do we consider it just stories and not part of history?
That's establishment control. You're absolutely right. I couldn't agree more. And I think that it is certainly non-negotiably an establishment collegiate thing. In Irish mythology, for instance, they simply divided it. They simply divided, just put a dividing line between what they call history, which is basically from about 500 years B.C. onwards, they will loosely accept as being historical, although obviously it's more from the time of Jesus Christ onwards. Right. But they, in Irish mythology, they'll concede and go back about 500. Anything before that was immediately labeled the mythological cycle. And I had problems with this. I mean,
right. Anything that we agree with is history. Anything that, that impinges on our paradigm of how we believe history happened is mythology.
Yep. It's another way of pigeonholing you when you find things that are not going to fit into the establishment status quo, you know.
Yes. And then they can always answer you by saying, if you do ask a question about it, they can say, yes, but that was myth. That wasn't history.
Yet,
that's
and yet the same
you know, the funny thing is that you have, you know, certain historians back in those days, you know, from, let's say, you know, 400 or 500 BC, right, that had written, and including even the time of Christ, you know, they written stuff, and we sort of accept those as facts for the most part. And yet, you know, other individuals that have written whatever, and any other writings that we find, we consider them myths. You know, it somehow doesn't jive.
They consider them stories, quaint stories that the ancient primitives used to explain the world around them and their social interaction with nature.
I mean, there's a limit to that, though, because, I mean, if let's say, a well-known historian had said, you know, this is what happened during that period, you know, and it becomes accepted as a fact, why would, you know, a different individual that has written something in that same period, all of a sudden, you know, other than the fact saying, you know, talking about a particular god or something of that nature, you know, could be thought as, you know, a storyline, yes. But how about, you know, factual things, things that, you know, they were talking about their particular times?
That's right. And we know, don't we, that the consensus is often broken from within the establishment, because then when you read a biography of some of these official people, they have a personal private interest in the so-called mythology. They usually have a healthy interest in things. We know this about Robert Oppenheimer, for instance, that he read the Mahabharata, he read the Vedas, he was always pontificating about the ancient myths. So, but they'll do it privately. And I know that a lot of them might wish that they could do it publicly, but they know that they'll lose their jobs. So even within the establishment, you have people who will always keep a party line in public or in their official textbooks, but you know that in their private life, they're actually very up to speed on some of this more esoteric stuff. So again, I just said, you know, to people, just forget what Big Brother's telling you and follow your interests and don't have these dividing lines so that they can pigeonhole you and say that if you believe in any of this stuff, it's just Grimm's fairy tales, Hans Christian Andersen. You know, they've been slowly through the years bringing it down to the level that you're going to feel very, very like a stigma if you believe these things. And yet, the same people who will label things mythology can then stand at Stonehenge, and I'm only mentioning that one because your viewers will be more familiar with it, but there's umpteen other ones in Scotland and Ireland, there's the ones in South America. They will go and stand there and then not be able to tell you how that got built. Well, wait a minute, right. You're the one talking about mythologies, you're the one who says, let's forget about everything that happened before a certain date, but you are also the one who goes on holiday to the pyramid and goes, wow, that's marvelous, I can't explain it. Well, maybe it would bloody help to explain it if you think that we've been around on this planet a lot longer and get rid of some of these, you know, mind-forged manacles that pigeonhole you into chronologies and this happened and that didn't happen and basically entire party line. And then another thing I'll say about the party line is that while you're not looking, every single one of these scientific disciplines hope that you're not looking because every 5 years they've got to rewrite their own textbooks and hope you haven't noticed.
Yeah. Right. With the new discoveries that are apparently new discoveries, but have been around for a long time. If you knew where to look.
If somebody was out there and even took a single subject like cosmology or geology or anthropology or even this fossil thing, it would be shocking to see how hypocritical the establishment is where they try to quietly phase out a pack of lies they told you 50 years ago replace it. And then when you confront them on it, they go, well, that's just a natural historical scientific process. We are not doing anything conspiratorial. We've just evolved in our knowledge. No, you bloody haven't. Because if you did, then you wouldn't have suppressed all those mavericks who were telling you those facts that now you admit back 50 years ago. Do not try to get off the hook by saying, oh, it's just a natural learning process. There's nothing untoward about that. Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah? I can take you to the graves of the unknown mavericks who tried to scream in your face these truths and you didn't listen to them and you ruined their lives. Do not tell me it's merely an erstwhile thing and when the year comes when you catch up, you'll be happy to accept it. Like this benign thing.
Right.
It's a malign thing. It's malignancy. There's nothing benign about it.
Yeah. Right, and that falls into the whole manipulation program, doesn't it?
You bet.
We were talking to Wade Frazier, and Wade Frazier, because he's been in the free energy area for a long time, he talks about it like you're scaling the ramparts, but you don't realize that in front of the ramparts, there's a great big, huge minefield, and people go dancing through the minefield thinking they can scale the walls of the free energy movement and bring this stuff out to the humanity as a whole. And they don't realize that all the time and money that's been invested in installing bigger and better walls and more mines in the field for you to get blown up with, like the patent process is just basically a red flag program that if you put a patent in for a free energy device, the red flag goes up and goes, oh, there's another one. You know, thanks for painting the target on the back of your head there.
Yeah.
Letting us know that you're—I mean, it's the same sort of thing that's going on, and it's got many different facets. It's not just one thing; it's many things. And he mentioned the same sort of thing that you did. You see, he said, "Oh, you can talk about UFOs, you can talk about abductions, and you can talk about paranormal stuff to a degree. You can talk about all these things, but mention free energy and see how far you get."
That's right.
They'll call it a perpetual motion machine, and perpetual motion is impossible. Just like when the Wright brothers flew, and all the scientists of the day said, lighter than air travel is impossible, therefore we don't have to go and look at what you're doing, because we already know it's impossible. Therefore, we don't even want to show up to your demonstration.
That's right.
And this is the same sort of thing. Go ahead.
Wasn't it Joseph Campbell who said that, according to all the properties of aerodynamics, a bumblebee shouldn't fly, but it does.
But it does.
So, yeah. In fact, according to biology, you shouldn't even be able to stand up. If you look, try to get a skeleton to stand up.
Yeah.
Without that obligatory hook hanging from that thing. Nobody can do it because that cavity of your stomach and the incredible weight of your head and your rib cage should immediately, despite the power of the spine or the muscles, should immediately cave in. People haven't even thought about the miracle of their own body. If they try to reconstruct one out of any type of tissue, it will never stand up. So how can a human being stand erect given the kind of posture and the alignments, and yet we do?
Wow. Have you done a lot of research in the, obviously, in the secret societies, the Rosicrucians? And what could you tell me about the Templars and, say, the Rosicrucians?
Anything you want to know. I've studied it all my life.
Okay. Because we were talking to Vincent Bridges, who studies the Rosicrucians and all the ancient secret societies, and he said something funny to me once. He said, well, Scott, if it's a secret society and you know about it, they're not very secret.
Well, their existence is no secret, but right. The rituals that they perform and what their hidden agenda is most definitely kept secret, even from brothers. That's why they have a fraternity system. So I don't quite understand what your friend there is trying to allude to.
I think what he was alluding to is there was other groups sort of behind the groups. Less well known. The circle of the, what do you call them? Brothers of the Garland, Brothers of the Circle, those sorts of things. Less known.
Well, the American Rosicrucians get their are allowed to stay in business because of an order called the Order of the Golden Rose that's mostly situated in Canada. They have a headquarters in Canada. I think it's in Toronto. I'm not sure. It might be Montreal. I can't remember. But they also are over in Germany. So the Red Rose Rosicrucians are connected to a group known as the Golden Rose. And then even if you get into the study of Rosicrucianism, you'll find that they have many splits within their organization. This was particularly the case in the 1700s in Germany,
okay,
where there was an enormous falling out between Rosicrucians based on, you know, whether there was going to be a left, what in our modern language it would be left-wing Rosicrucians who wanted a much more social-friendly king and much more socially friendly policies, and the more right-wing extremists who wanted to have a much more, you know, conservative and an autocratic type of setup in which the old standards, you know, would be maintained. So they have political divisions within them. They have other dynastic divisions. But basically, they also stick together as well. They have reasons for what they do. And many of these divisions that they have help them to move their agenda. But yes, there's definitely a case to be made for the fact that behind the lodges that we hear about,
right,
there are far more shadowy and sinister organizations, and it's absolutely true with the Rosicrucian Order. Behind them are a lot of very weird orders, including the Order of Sion, another one,
right,
you know, things like that. So yeah, there's a whole study of that, no doubt about that. Behind the Knights Templars, for instance, is the Cistercian Order. Behind them is the Irish Chaldees. Behind them is, you know, and from a European point of view, is the Carolingian dynasty and the Merovingian dynasty. Then behind those dynasties is even more elusive Eastern groups that I call the Athenists. And other people have their own take on who's, you know, when you go back into the mists of time, people have a different take on who was the original sort of group there. Lawrence Gardner calls them the Dragon Court. I do as well. So every scholar.
What could you tell me about the Dragon Court? If you've taken it back that far, what sort of time frame would you be talking about, and what sort of the makeup of that?
Well, Lawrence Gardner found evidence, direct evidence, for a Dragon Court in about the 13th dynasty of Egypt, and that's a hell of a long time ago. That's long before Akhenaten ever lived. And he in his books, he talks about the Dragon Court. I think he mentions it was a matriarchal line at that point. It had come through the female line up until a certain pharaoh of the 13th dynasty, if I'm not mistaken. But he also agrees that it is a much earlier thing, stretching back to Atlantis. In fact, the very term dragon is a sort of a nomenclature or a pseudonym for the Atlanteans, for the Nephilim. It didn't mean anything evil. It just meant it meant the same reason as why you see a serpent on the medical professions today. The dragon was an insignia that represented masters of the arcane knowledge, masters of genetics. That's why a serpent is often used to symbolize genetics. It's so old, it's new. So the dragon or the serpent is not just a symbol that came out of Judaism or, you know, recent times or whatever you want to call it. It's an extremely ancient cabal.
Right.
It goes back, oh, far, 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 far longer than most people would think. I see so many ridiculous books coming out that try to date it from, you know, the time of even the Jews, you know, God. I mean, just this nonsense. This thing is you can find the symbol of the dragon on stones that are going back, you know, literally thousands of years before the rise of anything to do with Judaism. So, and then what it means esoterically, that esoteric archive that the dragon symbol represents is absolutely ancient. It goes far, far, far back into ancient days. You have the Pendragons, don't you, in England and Ireland. The King Arthur's second name is Pendragon. That's already telling you that it's going farther, way back in ancient Celtic history before anyone had even heard of Jews or Christianity. So, I mean, this is just ridiculous.
So it predates all of that, yeah.
Yeah.
Do you think the connection between the Templars and the Rosicrucians, where do you think the connection may be?
I think it's been a while since I looked into this, but I think that there are connections. I think that what happens is that I'd have to really look that one up, what the exact connections between those orders are. I always assume they're all connected. There are certain, like, Rosicrucian-level degrees.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you pass those, you know, it all merges together. And I remember it's different in Britain and Europe than it is in America, where you have Scottish Rite Freemasonry, whereas the system in England is more York Rite Freemasonry.
Yeah.
And then you have your Catholic Protestant divide. Remember, if you were to speak about Knights Templar, you are strictly, from a layman's point of view, you're speaking about a Catholic order, whereas if you talk about Freemasonry, you're technically talking about a Protestant order.
Right.
Now, I'm able to handle all of that because I know that's just a bunch of smokescreen stuff.
Right. Yeah.
So when you're talking about Rosicrucians and somebody, well, which side do they fit on then? Well, that, you know, some people say they're meant to be Catholic, but then we know that that couldn't be true because Martin Luther's documents had the Rose Cross on it, and he was the very founder of Protestantism. So there's that shot to pieces.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I think remember the whole thing about Jacques de Molay being burned at the stake, the whole Templar suppression thing, and the Catholic Church came and got them and all that stuff.
Right.
So most people, when they hear about any of these orders, and I don't care who it is, Rosicrucians, Knights of Malta, you always have this overlay of religion on it. You're always thinking Templars, oh yeah, those Catholics that went to help Robert the Bruce, or oh, those Masons, those prods, you know. This has all got to be stripped away. Nobody's going to understand a damn thing as long as those religious connotations, I think they obscure the truth, as a matter of fact. I don't think they make things very clear at all. And they've been devised to give you the idea that when these Templar societies arose, they were friendly with the popes, they were friendly with the Romans. But again, this is nonsense, because the moment that you start believing in those religious divisions, how on earth can you then explain the camaraderie that the Roman elite families of Rome had with elite Jews? You see, immediately it falls down there. How can you show the camaraderie of certain Christian secret societies of which we've just been speaking, and the incredible amount of Jewish symbolism that they have? Every single Masonic lodge is dedicated to the Temple of Jerusalem. Every commander within it styles himself on a biblical Jewish, ancient Judaic personage, like Moses and what have you, right? They all their dramas are enactments of Old Testament scenarios. Wait a minute. Now, first you just confuse me. First you're telling me they're Christian, but then they have all this Jewish... See, so again, this is what I'm saying. The moment that you go from a traditional point of view and start bringing in these, what we know, street-level religious connotations, the whole thing becomes a mismatch, and people have actually almost gone insane trying to work it out. People who've tried to research the roots of... one of the things that drives them crazy, drives them potty, is trying to just simply establish how old Freemasonry is. If you're a student of these subjects, you will find yourself going, literally pulling your hair out, wondering, where does it begin? We've got the stonemasons, we got the accepted masons, 13th...
Oh, no. I think, did we lose them? That's interesting, though, because, I mean, what he's talking about is, I think we lost Michael. Hopefully we'll get him right back.
We lose him? Yeah,
I think. Well, he said earlier that his internet has been dropping on and off and on and off. But I think what he's talking about there is the fact that you can find the symbolism going back, and once you sit, you think you've found the end of it, it goes back further.
Yeah,
right? Of course. And it goes back further, you know, and further, and the thing further. Is, when are you going to stop, really?
The thing is, too, is Christianity on its own, without the Judaic connection, would not have worked back in those days, because when Paul had written
his letters
and stuff talking about Christ, by itself would not have done create a necessarily a religion, and if it did, it would have been very small.
Right.
I think the connection,
the inclusiveness, right?
Yeah. To the Judaic religion itself, gave it some merit as to what, this individual was and how far he went. So it's kind of funny how history is, and I don't think people have paid a whole lot of attention to it, unfortunately. And, we look at it blindly and we accept things blindly,
Well, I mean, it's just interesting the amount of work that Michael's done, because, and it does sort of remind me a little bit of what Michael Cremo was done, because Michael Cremo had all kinds of trouble with people coming after him when he, you know, published his book, Forbidden Archaeology. And he had to write another book just to answer the questions of all the people that were the detractors of his work, right? So,
yeah,
you know, it's very interesting. Well, hopefully we'll be able to get Michael back. I know he was saying that his internet is a little wonky right now, and it can go out for up to 10 minutes at a time. You know, when he was talking to me earlier today, he said, you know, his internet where he's staying right now is iffy, right? So if he needs to, he'll call in.
I'm back to now.
Oh, okay. There he is. Yay.
The connection went down.
Yeah.
I know you were, I was just saying to the audience that your connection's going, you know, it's on and off, right, today.
Yeah, it is. I just tried to call you on the phone as well, but somebody just put me on hold. But it just came back on the internet, so.
Yay. I was just filling it in because you're making an incredibly interesting point, because what you're saying is that if they start digging into the history of this, they're never going to be done. They're going to end up digging their way to China, because it's just an endless loop that they're going to keep.
Labyrinthine. It's totally labyrinthine, and it's by design. It's not that the religious thing isn't important. It is. But I'm saying that as you continue, I mean, in the early stages, of course, it's important to know that, look, the Merovingians were Catholic and this group was Protestant and all that. That's healthy, and it's great. But as you progress further, and this even goes for members. This is what members are going to have to be initiated in. Finally, I'm sure that as they progress, they themselves are told, okay, you could just lose all that rubbish that we told you about before, because now we're going to really initiate you into something even more high. And some people would say, to answer your original question, that the Rosicrucian levels, the true Rosicrucian levels, are very high. They'd say that those degrees are extremely high. It just depends what school you're coming from. Yeah. And other people say, no, those are basic. It's the Knights Templar degrees that are the highest. So, again, you know, I'm not a member, so I really can't say. I've just, from what I've discovered, it's like a take your pick. Some people say the Rosicrucian degrees are the highest. Some people say the Templar degrees are the highest. Some people say, no, it's these mysterious Illuminati degrees that are even higher, you know. So there's no consensus on this. Every author has his own spin on it.
What's your take like on the Rosicrucian story of how it began?
I think it's mostly an alchemical thing. I really can't see it being, you know, put into anything physical with this Christian Rosencrantz. I think these people deal heavily in metaphor, they deal heavily in parable, and mostly I think the Rosicrucian order specifically is very much rooted in alchemy.
Yeah.
In fact, the Rose Cross
said the exact same thing.
Oh, he did? Because that's interesting. Then we agree very much on that, because the Rose, even the
Bridges said, he said it's an interesting, what do you say? He said it's an interesting cover story.
That's right. There's no doubt about that in my mind. Yeah. And I think that it's something that's a very rich archive that other esoteric orders probably have borrowed from. There is some evidence to say that the Rosicrucian thing is extremely old. I mean, you know, but I believe that that goes for almost all of these esoteric orders.
Right.
And I love studying them. I mean, I would never dream of joining one. I disagree with them ideologically. I'm ideologically opposed to all secret societies, but I think they're fascinating to study. And Rosicrucianism is interesting because it has this interesting, artistic, dramatic, and also alchemical tie-in, which, of course, as we know from the people who've studied Carl Jung, there's even a crossover between alchemy and then modern psychology. So that's a very, very interesting field to be studying, you know.
Yeah, I think it's the fingers of the glove, not necessarily the glove or the hand that is in the glove.
I think you're right.
Yeah. Do you think there's any chance of the, you know, the treasure of the supposed Templars has was shifted with the Rosicrucians later, or do you think that the Templars themselves had moved it and hidden it somewhere?
I think they're all still in cahoots. I think they're I don't think their schisms matter that much. I haven't seen enough evidence for that. That doesn't mean that they don't have the occasional pillow fight. I mean, these guys are psychopaths to start with, so of course they're going to always have battles and wars and conflicts and stresses. and, you know, money shifting around. You remember when the Templars were suppressed? The Hospitallers, right. Some people believe that the Knights Hospitallers were given their loot to protect it. Others say that no, they actually absconded with it. We're happy that right. The Templars got suppressed. So there's a lot of back and forth with all of these things. Then you have the division between the Scottish in Scotland, the Scottish level of the Catholic dynasties of Templarism and Masonry, and then the English lodges, which, again, on the surface of it, appear to be more Protestant. So one can just approach it from a more fundamental point of view, which is often what's done on these television programs, where they just deal with it strictly in terms of Catholic and Protestant, and that when a Protestant hegemony comes in, they'll suppress or try to suppress the so-called Catholic side, and that can even lead to purges and pogroms and what have you, and then when the other side comes in. But usually that only happens, though, when the leader of the political dynasty is a complete and utter megalomaniac. For instance, like in the time of Mary, Queen of Scots, who was one of the worst psychopaths you can imagine. Yeah, under somebody like that, of course, there'll be these suppressions, but in a more benign monarch, he'll have them coexisting.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you spread the little bits of information out over many different, fingers of information, you put them out, not any one small group is going to collect all the information and have what if it translates to power. You know what I'm saying?
Right. Yeah.
But again, I would go back to the possibility of the hidden hand, or the ones that you don't hear about, the ones that you not the the, you know, we hear about the Rockefellers and the Rothschilds and all those guys, right?
Yeah.
But perhaps there's, I mean, we're bringing it now up into modern. I've just skipped from history to modern day, but you know what I'm saying. The Rockefellers, the Rothschilds, the Habsburgs, the list goes on and on of the public figures in the alternative media that are talked about. Is there even a layer behind that? I've wondered that.
Well, remember, let's take Professor Tolkien's work, Lord of the Rings, as a metaphor. You have okay. the evil, you have the, you have Saruman, right? The head of the wizards, who tries to cozet up to Sauron, the Dark Lord. So, first of all, you know that given a chance, one will try to rival the other, but when Saruman probably realizes he couldn't pull that off, he'll work for the Dark Lord. So there are these dynastic rivalries, and when you understand the anatomy of power, like you just alluded to, then you have the secret. Because I don't care who it is, if it's a corporation, if it's a set of individuals, or it's these secret societies, they all don't want too much power to get into the hands of their other group. When that power starts to get too strong, like it did in the case of the Knights Templars, which worried the Vatican. The Vatican and the Templars were one at one point, and the kings were one. But when, during the time of the Crusades, too much power, too much wealth, came into the hands of the Templars, then it started to worry even their own so-called friends, because then you become a rival, and then they seek to suppress you. For instance, there's an interesting fact that how come it was that only the Templars got suppressed, and not the Knights of Malta, the Knights Hospitallers, or the Teutonic Knights? And the reason is simply geography. Those other three groups made sure that they were well outside the boundaries of Europe. Teutonic Knights stayed on the fringes of Europe and Asia. The Knights of Hospitallers lived on the island of Malta, which is why they later became known as the Knights of Malta, and that they didn't bother anybody, and so they didn't, the eye of the kings and the eye of potential persecutors didn't fall on them. Where was the headquarters of the Templars? In Paris, right alongside the king.
Right, exactly. The king of France who wanted to get after him, right?
Right, so exactly. They were too conspicuous. They turned up in the major cities of the time, and their wealth and their power was too conspicuous. They let down their guard, and they made a fundamental mistake in doing that. And that's why, that could be the one reason why they were picked on more than all those other secret societies that had a little bit like, let's hide under the trees and not attract too much knowledge, too much attention.
Exactly. So if we go, I guess we just don't know what the, do you have like an ultimate answer about who's behind the current day power structure?
Oh, yeah.
Or is it, you do? Okay. Oh, yeah. I'd like to hear that.
They're generally called the Illuminati. They're a Luciferian cabal that I prefer to refer to as Atenism, the Atenists. Atenism being specifically a reference to the god that was worshipped by Akhenaten. Because we talked about the Dragon Court being very ancient. But I believe right. that the Dragon Court rose to enormous power under Akhenaten.
Mm-hmm.
That's when it reached, in the ancient world, its greatest power. Not that it didn't also rise after that time in Rome and Greece and in various other places. But one of its greatest heydays was under Akhenaten. I believe that was Dragon Court. That was a very special moment in the time of the Dragon Court, where, say, for instance, maybe they came out more into the open or whatever. And certainly that's why that pharaoh is of great fascination. Nice. And after he perished, they were thrown out of Egypt, and they found other homes in other places, including Babylon, Greece, Rome, and ultimately Britain as right. well.
There was a yeah. writer who wrote that Akhenaten was Moses.
Yeah, that's Sigmund Freud and some of his colleagues were, I think, the first to mention this. And I mentioned in my book who all the first ones were. And then now you have a modern, in the 1970s and 80s and 90s, there was other speculations. And then the man who really did an incredible work on that is my colleague Ralph Ellis. He's really clinched that. He doesn't go so far as to say that Akhenaten was Moses. He thinks it might have been a brother of Akhenaten called Thutmose, a young brother.
Okay, bloodline, okay.
Yeah, but basically the same thesis that, you know, I'm the one who actually says they were one and the same thing. I agree that they were one and the same thing. And but now I think that the evidence is in to show that either Akhenaten and Moses were the one and the exact same person, which is what I believe, or he was in the court very, very close to these Atenist kings. If not one of them, then he was very much in their circle. And this has been conceded by Sigmund Freud, who said the same thing, by Ralph Ellis, Mustafa Gadala, Ahmed Osman, and one or two other people as well. This is the pivot point of history. Nothing of our modern age can be understood until so do you go back to time.
Exactly. So do you see the Atenists as being a bloodline of the gods?
They certainly thought they were. Yeah.
Okay.
You could say that. Of the Nephilim, let's put it that way. In the sense that... They had dominion over the whole world. And then their desire to have even more dominion got exacerbated when they were finally kicked out. When they were finally kicked out of the greatest thrones of the time, which was in Egypt, then they set their, just like that James Bond motto, the world is not enough. Mm-hmm. I believe that is a direct reference to these world controllers. They wanted dominion of the world because they had lost Egypt and now nothing else, no other place would replace losing Egypt. So they had to then set their eyes on even a bigger pie, which was total dominion of the world, and they succeeded in getting it.
Right. And it's being played out as we speak.
And they always knew that when you want to control masses, whether and this was the same as it was back in Egypt, same as it was in Rome, you must use a two-pronged attack. You have to pacify people emotionally. That's with the religious aspect coming in. And you then also have the militaristic, autocratic, totalitarian, more monarchic, political type of control. They devised we don't even think, most people in the world don't even think about this. They don't even think about the fact of why are these two forms of control and why. It's based on the human psyche, that the human psyche can only be controlled up to a point through just political chicanery. You have to have another kind of control that will pacify and mind control him or through his emotional, spiritual body. There's an enormous two-pronged attack on the human spirit. And therefore, with the person who wants to be free of this sort of coercion, has to do it on many levels. He can't just do it on one level and say, well, I've seen this political thing's a big lie. But he's got to also handle all this other ideological stuff on the other side as well and break free from that.
So he goes over to the religious side. So I wonder is religion and government, are they just symptoms of something?
I think so. I really do.
They exist for a reason.
What's that?
Government and religion exist because they can, so they must be a symptom of something.
Oh, they have to exist side by side.
Yeah.
Look, the Christians say that Jesus was a man of love and don't kill and love thy neighbor, yet every abbot, monk, crusader, and all these Knights Templars we're talking about, so-called Knights of Christ, stop. You're carrying swords, you're marching out on crusades, you're butchering enemies, you're butchering yourself. Abbots and even monks used to wield swords in the Middle Ages. They'd wear a sword. And if you look at even some of the monuments and the regalia of these so-called monastic orders, you'll see them knights on horses and all of this militaristic regalia and the heraldry. Well, what has that got to do with Jesus' teachings about love thy neighbor? When you are walking around dressed in armor and going out in all sorts of barbaric crusades, there's something missing here. So I don't think then this is very much like Christianity in the purest sense. It's something else. It's secret society. Again, it's so obvious we don't even notice it. What on earth is swords and murder and genocide and wars got to do with the message of the gentle Jesus? Something's wrong there. But again, nobody seems to mind. Everybody just goes along their business. How many, even in modern days, modern warfare, you have your clerics waving them off to war, blessing the troops and all this malarkey.
Yeah, waving them off the ships. I'll mention something. I seen a video yesterday about one of the airships, the newer airships, that's going off to Libya. And it was like a promotional video. They had music, American rah-rah music playing in the background, and this thing flying through the air and shooting its missiles off and taking out tanks and and go America. And I was just, wow, that's, the guys walking towards the plane like Top Gun, exactly, like Top Gun.
And Tom Cruise, yep. Arnold Schwarzenegger, it's all Hollywood. It's just all Hollywood, big fiasco, good for TV. Don't worry about what's happening in the meltdown in America and the entire undercutting of the country and bringing it back to a level of primitivism. Yeah, let's get into the new video game.
Right. And then you get to see a snippet of talking about the freeing of the people of Libya. And then it's back to the missiles. Then it's back to the back to we're going to free you with murder.
This is psychopathy. And again, unfortunately, they know that people will go along with it because there's a lot of repressed anger in people, and this war, like always, has always exorcised people's demons. It would be laughable if it wasn't so tragic.
Right.
But I don't know how many times in many talks I've done where I've always made this reference to say that governments kill more of their own people than they ever kill foreign or external nations. Governments are in history. There's even a book written by a professor on it called, I can't remember the name of it right now, but it's a book that shows that, it's called Death by Government. And it literally proves the point that governments have historically, statistically, killed more of their own people, the people that they claim to be, working for or put in power by, than any outside force. So what does the facts tell us? But people just don't get it. They continue to vote for these demagogues who are so removed from the street level. They themselves are hiding behind their champagne glasses and their big budgets, yep. Same thing in the MEPs of Europe. They've lost complete and utter understanding what the working class man's desires are, what his daily life is like, the jeopardy that he's in, and we vote them in time and time again. That's identification. That happens through a psychological thing called the identification with the object of your hate. It's pure Freud. It's pure psychology. So that's why my work, again, in other areas, focuses a lot on the psychology, because without that, you're not going to understand anything about what's going on. These controllers know our psychology back to front. That's why they can put these video game type things up there, and you've lost your reality. It's a hyper reality that you don't even realize. This is happening. This is murdering. This is killing people. We're so out of our skulls. We're so lost in this hyper reality that we forget that these are dead bodies we're talking about here. This is real genocide,
Yeah, these are people being murdered.
Exactly.
It's like a game in a way.
It is a game. It's always been described by a game. They use it. They use that symbolism of the checkerboard. We've got right. The head Fabians talking about it as a game of chess,
mm-hmm.
A geopolitical game. It's a very, very elaborate game, one that's been played out for many, many millennia.
But it's a game that they can play while sitting in their nice, comfy chair, swishing their brandy and smoking the cigars. Right.
That's right. Tweedledum and Tweedledee. It's like the two kids on a rocking horse with a pillow. And it keeps them busy. It just keeps them busy. You do it on the tennis court. You do it on the fields of Eton. A little bit of sword fencing. A little bit of rugger. Well, let's have a battle today. Send out Lord Marlborough. Send out, Duke of Wellington. Now it's somebody else. This is just the gig. many people talk about the fact that about a couple of years ago, the Queen of England refused to turn up for the yearly memorial for the dead of World War I. And it caused a great scandal in the British media. I'm sure you heard about it. She literally refused to come out. I'm sitting there thinking, why did it ever surprise you that she ever came in the first place, being that she and her ancestry is German?
Yeah.
Exactly. While you're waving your British flags and then complaining that the Wicked Witch of Buckingham Palace hasn't bothered to come out to celebrate the British dead or the Irish dead. Well, where did you ever get the idea that she should come out in the first place, given that her family, her grandfather, her grandfather didn't speak a word of English and her father barely spoke the language? They're Battenbergs and Oldenburgs from Europe. They're the Habsburgs that you mentioned earlier. What on earth gave you the idea that they were really British? While you're waving your flags, she is of the enemy camp, for goodness sake, just in the same way that the Tsar's wife was a German. You forgot these things? They just don't matter anymore? Her lineage doesn't matter?
No, that's just it. That's just it. People do forget those things.
They do, yeah.
And they forget them quickly.
They quickly forget them, as partly because of the media and the propaganda. But the interesting thing about this is that these, when you finally do contemplate it, when I say this to my audience and they start to think about it, they go, well, what does that mean then? It means that these people have no allegiance to the countries in which they exist. They are internationalists. They may live in London, like these Irish politicians who've just sunk Ireland in the last year. They are maybe Irish by birth, but they have no care of the land of Ireland. These people are internationalists. We're surrounded by them. They've had years to even ensconce themselves in America through the federal systems. They may be born in America, like these, what's that clown that ran against Bush the last time? Kerry, whoever. They may look American and so forth and so on, but that is a total joke. That's another one of these hyper-realities. These people have no concern about borders. They work for secret societies and internationalistic concerns. And the faster American public understand this, the faster the change, real good change, positive change will take place. It's just the way it is.
And they hype up the whole puppet show of good guy going against the bad guy to free the good guys. You know, we believe in these guys over here. We're going to go over there and kill the opposition so we can free them.
Yeah.
Right? But they don't realize that these guys, they're not doing it because they're Americans. They're not doing it because they're part of the UN. They're not doing it for any of those reasons. They're doing it for other reasons.
Remember when you do training, you put your bayonet on and you run against these straw men that hang there? That's all this Gaddafi is. Gaddafi's part of the game. Just as we know that Saddam Hussein was part of the old Brotherhood network. These people sign on for the contract. They are part of the Carlyle group. They are all part of these same organizations. We should have learned this from the 9/11 fiasco when it even became bestseller stuff. Even Amy Goodman was talking about it. Come on, there's nothing that should not be understood now by the general rank and file of the world to know this is a setup. And these,
I think they're getting there. Oh, did we lose them again?
We have.
I think we have. But I think we're getting there, don't you? I have a positive outlook on this. I think that because of the internet and because of the alternative media, now, of course, you know, the alternative media has its own way of crawling around trying to figure things out, but and agendas, you know, obviously. But I think generally people are sort of figuring it out. My only question is it going to be figured out in time?
That part, I don't know. I think the general public, though, you know, just goes about their daily routine and you know, don't have the inclination into looking more into, you know, all these other areas.
I think so.
You know, I'm not quite sure that if you know, in the future things are going to change the mentality of the world. You know, it's pretty much you know, a given that it's very easy to manipulate them. And I mean, you know, look, we have elections again. Who are we going to pick? How many choices do we have? You know?
Yeah. You have the illusion of choices.
You know, are we going to pick liberals or are we going to pick the other guys again? You know, so it doesn't, you know, it doesn't give you the incentive to go out and vote because, you know, it's always the same folks. And really, no matter who you pick, you know, it's the same. It's the same folks.
It's the same cycle.
You give them a different color, maybe. You know, one guy is red, the other guy is blue. But you know what? They're the same people.
It's the worldwide wrestling of politics.
Yeah.
In this corner,
look at the Americans. We have, you know, a two-party system, and that's it. And you know, it's been going on for umpteen, you know, of years, and you know, the Canadian, and you know, of course, most of the countries out there, the same thing. You know, they'll have like two or three political systems, and that's the way they drive for, you know, 100 years or longer, or whatever.
And that's been going on for as long as history's existed. This isn't just a new thing that you know
because people are sheep. People are sheep, and then, you know,
they'll easily let the book for something to be led. It's the independent stuff that you. Oh, it's the independent
Michael,
stuff.
Okay, before we close up, Michael, I got to ask you this question.
Okay.
Where do you think that we came from, or are you in the Darwinian side of things?
No, not at all. I don't buy into that in most of shape or form at all. I think we've been around here for many, many more millennia. Somewhat what we were talking earlier about Michael Cremo's work, there's so much evidence to show that the Darwinian thing is ultimately deeply unsustainable. That's a huge subject I hope to get into in a future time. But, you know, yeah, so I think the human race has been around here for a lot longer than we know about.
And whether we were,
do you think that we came from somewhere, though? Or?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think that my work picks up from the time of an alien invasion, an alien intervention, anyway, that changed us. So that's basically where I start. The question of, you know, did this planet have, or what were the kind of people like on this planet before that intervention? Your guess is as good as mine. We know so little about it that I'm still myself studying that. I think it's a very intriguing question, but my main focus is about what we became after this interference.
Right, and where we're going. Because I've sort of have a little pet theory that humans are destined for space, and I think that's part of a planetary evolutionary cycle. However many times that cycle has happened, I can't say. But you have a planetary evolutionary cycle, and eventually, you know, you head to space. But do we really need, maybe this is part of the elite plan, do we really want 6 billion or 7 billion or 9 billion people going to space, or do we want just the select few?
Exactly, good point. Yeah, you'll soon find that they'll monopolize that like everything else.
Right. So what's going to happen to I mean, they could just get on their fancy toys and go off into the universe and do what they're going to do and leave us be on planet Earth. But do they still want to maintain a foothold here on Earth? You know, I'm getting into, you know, future stuff or possible future stuff. But I think that, and I don't know about 2012, personally, I think 2012 is the year between 2011 and 2013, but there does seem to be a lot of strange things happening with the sun and, you know, I don't know. I don't have an answer for that personally.
There is some strange, really crazy things happening cosmologically, absolutely, and these people are obsessed. I mean, you only have to look at H.G. Wells and his work, Things to Come. Right. They are obsessed with getting off the planet, with seeking new lands and colonizing. It's just in their blood to do that. The group that I talk about that were originally alien weren't from this planet in the first place and have not particularly relished the fact that they've been contained here all this time. And so they couldn't think of anything more fantastic for them than to be able to, again, build that technology back and get off this planet. That's central to my thesis as well, is that they have no love for this planet. And of course, what we see happening on this planet, it lends a lot of evidence to that, you know.
Yeah, it's true, because it does. It's like they want to get off, and they need us for a certain amount of time, like labor,
mm-hmm.
to build the toys, and then that's it. Once we're done our job, then they don't need us anymore.
You got it.
And whether you're going to bring in the catastrophic stuff, and for all we know, ancient cultures have been writing about this time period for a long time. Or is it this time period?
That's a good point. But it seems that even if people wouldn't buy into that, the ancients had an enormous knowledge. I buy into it because there's actually Irish prophecies that do talk about the future to come, and they're bleak. And you have the similar prophecies in Nordic. I mean, we're talking very ancient sagas here, ancient references to the future time. You have it in the Vedas, allegedly you have it with the Maya as well. And again, that's only what's left to us. We know that a lot of stuff got destroyed. So I don't see that enlightened people of the past would have any problem being able to tell that cycles come and go.
Right.
The Vedics have an elaborate system of timing in which you have these dark ages and so on. So I don't see any problem with that.
Yeah.
Anyway, Michael, we got to get going, and I want you to give your websites for people to come and check out all your material and books.
Also, if you're going to be doing any lectures or any events coming up, just feel free to mention that as well.
Nothing too soon. For events, people can go to my calendar page. It's on the forum, and you get to the forum by going to my main website, just michaeltessarian.com. Just go there, and all my writings and DVDs are there. And the calendar for a few upcoming interviews and upcoming events is on the MSAR forum. The link is right on the michaeltessarian.com website. And I also have to get going. I saw our time was up. It's been a fantastic interview.
It's been a fantastic time, Michael. Mm-hmm. And I also want to apologize to our audience. I know we had a number of people that wanted to ask you some questions, but I guess we're going to have to leave that for next time.
Keep those questions. That question from that lady before was really great. So, keep those questions for next time.
Yeah, that was Josh. Josh sent that question in from 2012info.ca. He sent that question in.
Okay.
All right.
It was great talking to you. I really appreciate you coming on. Hopefully, you can come on again, and maybe we could talk about the Irish origins of civilization. I know that's older material, but I love that information.
Well, there's always new part. I'm always finding new things. I'm always updating that. So it's not really that old, because there's always new discoveries happening all the time. And, commercial-free radio, when you get more time to get into things deeply, I'm all for that. So thank you very much for that.
We generally don't do commercials. Don, the owner of BBS Radio, is doesn't care. If you want to do commercials, do them. If you just want to talk for 2 hours, knock yourself out.
Yeah.
It's great that way. And there's not very many formats. And also, I will mention here that all of our complete program, from beginning to end, is free on our website. Or you can sign up at BBS Radio, which has over 60 hosts with over 10,000 hours a week of programming. I mean, BBS Radio does more in 1 week than a lot of shows do in a year. So it's a huge. So if you sign up to the archives for BBS Radio, you're getting a very large collection of information you can get. But if you want to go to our website and listen to the full version of this, you will be able to do it in our archives tomorrow. We also have a YouTube page, which is Spectrum Radio Network on YouTube, and we make up the complete interview on YouTube as well. So no listen to half and charge for half. It just doesn't work that way.
Okay, so
thanks again.
I'll get a link to the interview on YouTube as well.
Yeah. What I'll do is I will be uploading the archive tomorrow on our site. BBS Radio will have it tomorrow, probably tomorrow afternoon on their site. I'll have it on my site as well. And then in about 2 weeks, when I get around to it, I add images to every single, to the audio, and then make a YouTube version out of it. So what I'll probably bug you for some from images as well, Michael.
Okay, okay. Tuck, we got to get going here.
We got to go.
Okay. All the best, guys.
Thank you very much.
Take care.
Have a great day. And we'll see you guys next week.